Hi, this is an encore performance of the best with Dr. Kathleen Smith. I looked through my archives and I realized Dr. Kathleen was coming to town to do a lecture in 3 weeks at a conference. Realizing that, I pulled this interview out so we can listen and hopefully, let's cross our fingers, we can get her on the show again. So listen, learn, and enjoy Dr. Kathleen O'Neill Smith.
Hi, this is Take Charge Your Health with Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist, physician assistant, and Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Listen, learn, and I hope you enjoy the show. Bye.
Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information and bring it home to you and your family. With years of clinical experience between us and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, we give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back, welcome back. We're continuing our series on bringing to you the best of the best from medical conferences. So we're bringing to you information that might be new to doctors who were not able to participate in this individual conference. But their conference is directed toward educating doctors and other health practitioners. Carol just returned from a conference that was so impressive, we decided to do a whole show on it. We have a guest, also Dr. Kathleen O'Neill Smith, who Carol will introduce. But first of all, Carol, could you tell us about this conference?
The conference, I've attended this conference for several years now. I am delighted to see that the attendance is growing and growing. It's the IMMH, Integrative Medicine in Mental Health. There are at least 600 attendees this year.
Wow.
Which is fabulous.
That's really big.
600, yeah. It was a big, big conference. What is really interesting to me is the growing interest in getting down to the basics. We sort of are floundering when people do have mental health problems. We're floundering with pharmaceuticals that we don't really understand and that really do not bring about resolution of these problems in a practical way. Drugs never actually do this very well. They moderate excesses generally is the most thing, but they forget everything they're blocking, and they forget about the thing that made an excess. They're not looking at the basic biochemistry. So this conference had a number of really good speakers, and we looked at hormones, we looked at nutrients, but the underlying element here is something really basic. I just love it. Like the Chinese say, death begins in the colon. Everything goes back to our gut and our digestion and our microbiome in our gut. So I thought it would be really cool if we shed some light on some of these features and if we would help give people some practical things they can do to make sure they keep their gut in good working order. And it affects not only mental health, it affects your whole body and the functioning of your body. So I'd like to also say we brought, should we call you Dr. Kathleen, Dr. Kathleen?
That sounds great.
So we met actually at a conference, and that was serendipity, I thought. We are committed to being up to date and learning the things that can actually work for people. Like Dr. Kathleen's been an Olympic athlete. She works and breathes in Boston, where she comes from originally, and studied there too, and now practices there. But we're so grateful to have you on the line today, Dr. Kathleen, to help round out this conversation.
That's great. It's great to be here. Thank you.
I wanted to start out with something I've been looking at from various speakers for a while, and it's the problem of endotoxins, or LPS, lipopolysaccharides. They say either, it's interchangeable. And it has to do with a disordered digestive tract and an abundance of gram-negative bacteria. And those things, the endotoxins, I'll stick with endotoxins. I like the toxin part of it. It's really a breakdown products or excretion products of these bacteria. Now, all would be well and good, except we are developing tendencies for the barriers in the digestive tract between cells that are being broken open. And another piece of this is these endotoxins are fat soluble, and the conditions that would promote absorption into the bloodstream, where these endotoxins cause no end of inflammation and development of autoimmune type reactions, fat absorption is enhanced by a high fat diet if you're not careful. Given the tendency now, we're looking at keto diets much more. We have finally come to the realization that a high-carbohydrate diet has been promoted for the last few decades, making us fatter and fatter and fatter. And the science is good. We're turning to higher-fat diets, which could be a problem with absorbing these toxins if we don't know how to deal with it. Dr. Kathleen recently did a lecture at a conference, and you covered that a little bit about the cell walls and the endotoxins. Do you want to comment?
Sure. Well, I think the gut, restoring our gut instinct and getting our guts getting us to honor our guts and understanding how they affect all parts of our body is really important. And as you said, Carol, death can begin in the colon, but also what happens in the gut does not stay in the gut. It is Vegas. It is not Vegas. Pardon me. It is not Vegas. So, and, you know, people say when in doubt, follow the money. Well, when in doubt, follow your gut. So the thing about the gut is that the whole gut-brain axis is very, very important. And we're learning more and more about that, as you say. We're learning more about how diet affects that. We're learning more and more about how the gut affects the brain and the brain affects the gut. And this is actually a bi-directional. It goes in both directions, communication. And it's really important to understand when things leak through the gut, they directly, almost many times instantaneously affect the brain. And with higher fat diets, whether it's a keto diet, a ketogenic diet, or a high fat diet from a standard American diet, a SAD diet as we call it, mm-hmm. then one way or the other, you're going to abrade the one cell membrane lining between the outside world and the inside world through the gut. The gut, when we eat food, it is information to our body. And when it sits in our gut and just degrades the wall of the lining of the gut, which is only one cell layer thick, and you get increased permeability, as you say, these endotoxins or these metabolites, these chemicals that are derived from the bugs, it's like getting, you know, the poison from the mosquito or the snake or whatever it is. When that gets into your system, it's like a gas. It's like carbon monoxide. It goes really quickly. It isn't carbon monoxide. I'm not suggesting it's that, but it flows in that way very quickly to the brain, to the joints, to the skin, and to various parts of the body. And with this mental health crisis that we have in the country, And with the attempt at treating it with these psychotropic medicines, I think we really need to step back. We really need to say, let's restore our gut instinct. Let's understand the bidirectional communication between the gut, the microbiota or the bugs in the gut, the microbes in the gut, and the brain, the direct connection to the brain. And in healing the brain, whether it's anxiety, depression, mood, any of those things, we need to consider a multifactorial approach, an approach with cocktails, if you will, that address the brain, the gut, the immune system, the hormones. And I have a very simple approach to this, and it's a pyramid approach, starting with assessing nutrients first, second, hormones, third, the immune system, which may involve PRP or other treatments. We'll come back to that, or probiotics, as simple as probiotics. Fourth, peptides, which are bionatural regulators. And lastly, stem cells, activation of stem cells within the body. Very simple approach. So I think it is really important for us to be thinking
minute,
about
wait
that.
Wait a minute. Dr. Kathleen, that's a lot of stuff you just talked about that
I think
looked into very well.
Well,
go ahead, Chris.
I think we dove in a little bit fast because we... Whoa, Carol, you got my head spinning. And part of it is that we were talking about a mental health conference and you immediately started talking about endotoxins. And I don't think we made the connection. And the part that's so exciting about this conference was, one, mental health professionals are coming together and they're saying, hey, these psychotropic drugs that we're giving out like M&Ms at a child's birthday party, number one, they're not working. Number two, they're not balancing. And number three, there's more to the question. In this conference, there's an amazing brand new concept that the brain is connected to the body. What a surprise. I remember when, years ago, the psychiatrists would send patients to me because they had no interest in hormones. And they said, well, maybe hormones will help you, while they were putting them on a Prozac. So what is so exciting to me about the conference you went to is, one, the awareness of the mental health professionals, because I think they were left in the dust in the fact that they really were not looking at the human body in its entirety. They were just throwing more and more and more drugs at a problem. And now they're saying, they're turning their profession around. And it started out, I remember you used to tell me there'd be 150, 200 people at the conference. Now there's 700 people, mental health care professionals, and they're studying about endotoxins. This is pretty exciting.
That's pretty revolutionary.
And revolutionary, and they're looking at a whole new paradigm of where does mental health come from, and how do we approach treating it. And what Dr. Kathleen said that was so brilliant, she said, it all begins in the gut. It all begins in the gut. When you look at how well your thyroid is functioning, you better look at your gut. When you look at any infertility problems, you better look at your gut. When you're looking at depression, we better look at our gut. When we're looking at autoimmune disease, where do we look? When we're looking at joint problems, when we're looking at osteoporosis, we better start looking directly at the gut. So I was totally excited when you went to this conference. I kept on calling you, send me papers. Send me papers, because I couldn't go to this one. So Dr. Kathleen, how does all of, you just said it all. You said whenever you're looking at a problem, you're looking at hormones, you're looking at diet, you're looking at You're looking at nutrients, then you're looking at intake, then you're looking at hormones, then you're looking at peptides. But what are peptides?
Well, peptides naturally occur in the body. So interestingly, when we think about our brain and our neurochemicals, they're made of peptides. And many hormones are peptides. So peptides occur naturally in the body. And when you think about our brain, it's our most fragile organ. And our gut is designed to deliver the nutrients to the brain to make the neurochemicals. You don't have a Prozac deficiency. You don't have an Effexor or a Venlafaxine deficiency. You don't have a Valium deficiency when you're born. And we treat many times with those kinds of neurochemicals, or they're intended to affect neurochemicals, but they never restore what's missing. Our brain is directly impacted by our gut because it needs those nutrients. It is also, as our most fragile organ, most susceptible to imbalances in nutrients from a poor diet. It is most susceptible to these endotoxins or allergens or environmental triggers or chronic inflammation, high sugars, or chronic stress. And so it's really important when we think about how worn down some of these peptides are. Insulin is a peptide, and many, you know, the percentage of people with diabetes in our nation, it's ever growing. And we need to understand how these peptides can function. So there are many peptides that we can return back to the body, you know, through oral means or subcutaneous means like we do with insulin or other, that we can treat that will restore balance and communication between organs like the gut and the brain, communication within the brain, communication within the gut. And it's really important that we begin to, as clinicians, learn about that and as patients learn about that, because that's what's going to regenerate and revitalize us from our foundation, from our foundation.
I would like to mention here, one of the major presenters was Dr. Dale Bredesen.
Oh.
He's written a book called The End of Alzheimer's. And he said the problem with what we have been doing is looking at Alzheimer's as having one cause, and you've already mentioned this, Dr. Kathleen, nothing has one cause. There's multiple things playing a role. His book is absolutely phenomenal. He identified about 6 or 7 subtypes, but it's touching on some of the things you were touching on. There's toxicity issues, there's hormone and nutrient deficit issues, there's inflammation issues, there's heavy metal issues, there's yeast in the gut issues. All of these things are contributing to what we know as Alzheimer's. And he uses this metaphor in his book and every time he lectures. He said, imagine you have a roof, and you have 36 holes in your roof, and you find something to patch up one hole. You still have 35 holes. You still have Alzheimer's. Unless you evaluate patients or everything that is bothering them within the realm of the things we're talking about, and then repair those things, detoxify from this. Metals, get the toxins out of your life, make sure you have good nutrition, make sure your gut is working. All of these things are a piece of this puzzle. Mm-hmm. So there is no one cure for Alzheimer's. There's a myriad of things that can be done for an individual as long as you take everything into consideration. What the needs of that particular patient is. Patients will be different from person to person. One of the really exciting things I learned at that conference, Dr. Bredesen, independently of this conference, is teaching practitioners how to do this. And his book is is really, really excellent. He breaks it down. He tells you how to tease out what the problem is, what you're looking for on tests, what the optimal might be, and how to treat. He's got like a cookbook for people who want to reverse their Alzheimer's disease or if it's incipient, you already know that. There are so many things you can do to change it, and so many tools in the toolbox. I was really excited, right, independent of this conversation, is a whole cadre of practitioners getting trained so they'll be able to help.
Well, it really sounds like what he's doing is remembering that there's biochemical individuality and that we are not treating a disease process, we're treating an individual who presents with their unique makeup, not just their genetic makeup, but their nutritional makeup and their toxin exposure makeup, and I think that's really important. And when you come back to the gut, Carol, you and Corinne and I all know, and we've all practiced under the 4-5-R principle, whichever one you want to call it. Everybody has their little favorite, but it's remove. First, remove. Remove exposure to toxin. Remove exposure to metal. Remove exposure to the high-fat diet that's inflammatory, that's delivering these toxins into the body readily, these LPS toxins, these lipopolysaccharides, these I call them little pieces of LPS. And basically, they pass right through. They either pass through the cells between them or they pass through the cell itself, which is really scary. And so we really want to think about removing, and we have to figure out what is it that needs to be removed from an individual's environment or a lifestyle or diet. And then the second thing that we want to do is we want to replace. You need to know what is it that needs to be replaced. What are those 35 holes missing or 36 holes? So what is it that needs to be replaced? And this is a process to figure out. And the way that you approach it is you try to find what are the biggest things that are missing. You know, you can't get overwhelmed. This can be very overwhelming for doctors and for patients. Where do we start? You've got to have phases. And you've got to determine through these biomarkers and through these ranges and reference ranges, where am I going to start? So you replace and you return back the nutrient levels that the individual needs based on their story and based on their biomarkers. And then thirdly, you re-inoculate. The microbiome, the open biome project that involves multiple major medical centers in this country is actively underway. And the microbiome is enormous. And what we've learned because of artificial intelligence more recently is enormous amounts. We are going to have probiotics that will address anxiety, probiotics that will address arthritis, probiotics that will address kidney failure. I use one now for all reduced kidney function for a probiotic. So we have to begin to re-inoculate. The other thing is that there's a whole other area, the endocannabinoid area, the cannabinoids that act on the receptors in our brain that produce happiness and pleasure and vitality and vivaciousness and all of those things we're also learning about. So we've got to go through and we've got to figure out what needs to be removed, what needs to be replaced. Is it a hormone? Is it a nutrient? How do we re-inoculate? What probiotic do we use to re-inoculate? And what is the ultimate in regeneration? Will it involve a peptide therapy? Will it involve a platelet-rich plasma therapy? And will it involve stem cell therapy? So there is a framework that's relatively good to follow. If you're a patient, you can ask your clinician about it. You should seek a clinician that's up to date. As you're saying, Carol, there are now 600-700 at these conferences. And you should also continue to, you know, search the internet to try to find what are some of the latest things that I want to talk with my clinician about.
So you're recommending Dr. Google as a consultant as well.
Well, I don't really think that people should confuse their Google search with a medical degree. However,
and some people do.
It initiates a framework for a conversation so that you don't go down a path of no return with your health.
The other
you're really just
No, go on. I love that. The path of no return with your health.
The one thing that concerns me in medicine, most importantly, is when we get rid of a symptom but never treat the problem. And my primary example of that is steroids. Corticosteroid injections into back for back pain, into knees for knee pain. They basically take away the symptom, but they never heal it. Now, you can do a similar treatment. You can take away the symptom, and you can also do healing if you're using PRP or another type of treatment. So I say that basically steroids will shut the lights out, and you'll never know what's going on behind your back, whereas an alternative treatment that's healing will turn the lights on, get rid of the symptom, and do the healing. And that's the kind of therapy that you want to request from your clinician.
That's beautiful. I wanted to bring it back down again, back down to people. And I wanted to start with an example. And the example is this book that I read actually years ago. And it was Have We Done Enough for This Child? It's by Sydney Baker, John Pangborn, and Bernie Remlard. And in the back of it, it showed, it interviewed 40,000 parents of autistic children and asked them what therapy was the most effective of anything that they had received. And by far, number one, miles above any other therapy, was removal of wheat. That the mothers saw the most difference in their children after they excluded wheat from the diet. So I wanted to talk about that. At this point, we'll take a quick break. We're speaking with Dr. Kathleen O'Neill Smith, internist, practitioner of wellness medicine, on the board of the Peptide Research Association, on the board of Stem Cells, and one of the coaches for the U.S. Olympic rowing team. When we return, we will be speaking about the effects of wheat on the brain, on the body, on the immune system. Be right back. And we'll be right back. Is Take Charge of Your Health, and I'm Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist, physician assistant, with my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist, and we're speaking with Dr. Kathleen O'Neill Smith, practitioner of treating wellness, on the board of the Stem Cell Society, on the board of Peptide Society, and a coach for the U.S. Women's Olympic rowing team. We're speaking about the gut-brain connection. Enjoy. Because wheat is something so simple and yet so powerful, creating such havoc in our body, many of us don't really understand. Well, maybe I'll just get organic wheat and that will help. Yes, it does help. I agree, it is much better. But what are the properties of wheat that's creating this intestinal inflammation, which is allowing the gut to become leaky and allowing all these other poisons passage into the system. Can you explain that, Dr. Kathleen?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that I didn't know originally was that when we take wheat or flour, particularly wheat flour, that it's made of a whole bunch of amino acids. And some of them are called gluten, and there are multiple types of gluten. There's alpha gluten, omega gluten, there's alpha beta gluten. There's many kinds of gluten. So when you get measured at your regular doctor's office for gluten and they say there's no problem, they haven't even touched the surface. So they really basically are potentially giving you a false negative result. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's many kinds of gluten. In addition, in wheat, lectins are a type of protein that can be very problematic and really affect mental health. A little bit of lectin can have a much larger impact than gluten, and we don't really even measure lectins. There's glutenin, there's farinins, there's purinins, and I measure these in my patients, and it's remarkable what I find. But regardless, wheat of today is not the wheat of yesterday. And the way that we grow, the way that we process, and the way that we consume the wheat is very, very different. Store it, consume it, you name it. It has a significant impact on our microbiome. And back to what Carol was saying, it has a significant impact on toxin, endotoxin, increasing the permeability of the gut, making the gut more leaky, making an easier passage for a hole to be created so that these endotoxins can get into the body and directly affect any other area of the body, including your brain, your most fragile organ, your skin, your joints. And if you have a skin problem, you have a foggy brain, or you have any headache, or you have any brain problem, ADD, memory issue, ability to make decisions readily, if you have any joint problem, you need to look at wheat. Wheat will feed microbes within the biome of the gut, the microbiome of the gut, and those microbes will munch on this wheat, nyah, 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 chomp, 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 and they will make a metabolite, a gas. It doesn't even have to be something that we can see. It can be a gas. It can be it's an endotoxin. It's a metabolite, and it can pass directly without even breaking down the membrane. It can get into the body. It can go through between the cells in a big hole, or LPS, those little pieces of
bleep,
can go through the cells as lipopolysaccharide and disrupt any organ system in the body. Wheat, as Alessio Fasano at MGH, who runs the gut mucosal immunity program, will tell you, wheat is not good for any body or anybody. Wheat will cause inflammation, leaky gut, endotoxin into the body, in every single body. There's no one who's immune to it. Whether you feel the effects and how much you need to get the effect is the differentiating factor. And that depends upon your genome and your biome. So it's really important to address wheat, and it's really important to know how to measure whether or not you're sensitive to wheat. But at the very least, minimizing or getting rid of wheat in the diet will solve a lot of problems.
There's another piece to this that has been evolving, and that is that in growing wheat, farmers have started putting glyphosate on their crops just before harvest. Now, wheat is not a GMO crop, and glyphosate was developed for GMO soy originally, but it is an herbicide, so it kills the leaves and the stuff, so it's easier to get at the grains when you harvest it. And that practice has become really widespread. We have no idea if we do pick out a bread somebody's manufactured, or even the flour, if you're somebody who's trying to make it yourself and you don't think you have a gluten problem, but now you have a problem with glyphosate. And as it turns out, glyphosate is now known for really poking holes in your gut, essentially.
Absolutely.
For LPS and or endotoxin.
It also,
it's quite shocking that this would go into practice and we'd be totally unaware.
It also is documented that it's poking holes in the blood-brain barrier. So it's poking mm-hmm. holes in your intestinal barrier, and then it oozes into the body, and it's literally creating permeability in the blood-brain barrier. So your natural protection for toxins, because our body protects our brain, or attempts mm-hmm. to, is now being broken down by this herbicide. So we wonder why people become so psychological, sometimes depressed, sometimes brain fog after utilizing or eating wheat products. But also, we got to look at our thyroid too. When someone walks in with Hashimoto's, first thing I do without even, we don't even need to talk anymore, is I pull them off of wheat. Number one.
And you guys are generous. I get everybody off of flour, period. Hello, you are.
They think they have a thyroid problem, and they say, no, you have a gut problem.
I know. It's confusing, but Corinne, I agree with you.
Well, that's...
It's interesting. Just as a quick aside, William Davis wrote Wheat Belly, and although wheat isn't a GMO crop, it's been selectively bred, and he said originally we had like a 12 DNA pair wheat, and now it's up to 42 DNA pairs. It's an entirely different animal than our historic wheat. So we're dealing with something our body didn't develop with. We never encountered that thing before. Very interesting.
I have a patient who is in his late 20s. He just graduated from MIT Business School and moved to New York, and he has been so, lived in Boston, obviously, and was so sick, had been to many, many doctors, headaches and problems that were really debilitating. He was also a very good athlete and had come to my practice. And what was really fascinating for him, and, you know, is made sense to me because of this conversation where we're thinking about what we do to our wheat and the glyphosate, he was so sick here, spent 6 weeks in Australia doing a project through school. He ate everything in Australia that he eats here and had no problem. No problem. No problem. Why do you think? What would you speculate, Carol?
Back to an entirely different kind of DNA wheat or something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The way that they grow their food is not the way that we grow it.
Yeah, but I think it's the same seed, though. I think it's the same seed.
No, it isn't.
It isn't?
I don't think it is.
Okay.
No. But there's various seed banks, and different countries have actually different varieties of wheat, even, and it's been developed for their particular climate, and it's impossible to make a broad statement, except for in our own country, we do know that the particular variety of wheat that we are using is very hard on our digestion, has multiple gluten factors that are bothering us, and now additionally have been loaded in some cases with glyphosate. And because when they harvest wheat, they dump it all together, we really don't have control over how much of the wheat has this added glyphosate. So we have a problem in our country with wheat across the board. And what about other grain products? Just as an aside, we're seeing a lot of products being brought out as gluten-free, but also are grainy, containing buckwheat and quinoa. Do patients actually do better on these things, or should we be avoiding grains too for our gut?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think that's a complicated question. So what I think, again, I come back to biochemical individuality. And one thing I just want to say is that glyphosate is also known as Roundup, and it's pretty mm-hmm. omnipresent and doesn't break down readily. So it really is a problem environmentally and to the individual. So that aside, I don't like to broadly suggest that populations or all of my patients get rid of grains, because I think that's a little bit hard to accomplish. So for me, I like to promote what I can measure. And if I can measure that someone isn't responding well to a variety of the proteins in wheat, then I will measure that and I will suggest that wheat is an issue. And I will suggest whether it's gluten or purines or if it's lectin or what component of the wheat is really a problem so that we can really try to isolate what we're talking about. You can also measure antibody response to not gluten-free products. And I think that I will try to measure that, and then if that seems to be posing a problem based on data that I collect from an individual, I'll suggest it. Otherwise, I'll start with just wheat, because there are a lot of B vitamins. We talked earlier about NAD and different B vitamins. There are a lot of B vitamins in grains, and if we could have healthy grains available to us that our body could readily digest with all the without all the endotoxins, then we would be healthier as well. Those B vitamins are critical for neurochemical function, neurochemical creation and breakdown, like serotonin and dopamine and all of those great brain chemicals. But I think that what we need to do is figure out for an individual what are the grains that their body can tolerate. And we can do it initially with an attempt at getting the data through the blood. If that doesn't work, we can do small based elimination protocols where we pick two or three things that they eat commonly, get rid of them for 21 to 28 days. And I think it's just important to have a coach, a guide, a clinician guide you through how you're going to go about that and how you're going to keep a symptom log in order to do an elimination protocol if you don't have the data through the blood work to direct you.
Which blood test do you do?
I do a whole variety, but I think that, you know, Dr. Vajani, Aristojo Vajani mm-hmm. in California at Cyrex mm-hmm. is a brilliant man. Mm-hmm. And I think he's really committed to really health and reducing disease, particularly autoimmunity, through the GI tract, through these endotoxins, because ultimately any of this LPS that gets into the body is setting us up for a tremendous amount of autoimmune conditions. And where the body gets confused through the what wheat looks like versus what our own thyroid looks like and doesn't know and attacks the thyroid. Those are, you know, that's a whole different topic. But I love the Cyrex protocol. I think it's really beneficial. I think it's extensive. And I think Dr. Vajani is brilliant. So I really kind of follow that pathway to try to make these diagnoses and to try to not really be making it up. I try to have more of a trial and error approach as opposed to this hit or miss random approach.
Mm-hmm.
But if I need to, I can go back to hit or miss. And certainly wheat is the number one thing that needs to be eliminated.
Mm-hmm. So,
Dr. Kaplan, earlier we talked about in your presentation, you also cautioned people about fasting and its impact on the gut. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Mm-hmm. I think fasting can have its benefits, and there's a lot that's written presently over the last year and a half on fasting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of studies out of California, University of Southern California,
mm-hmm.
some of the doctors there that really are promoting the benefits of fasting. And I think fasting, certainly reducing endotoxins or endotoxemia or toxins getting into the system, can be benefited from fasting. But fasting is tricky business. Fasting will promote us utilizing our fat, which I think is healthy and can be good. But I think that fasting can, in individuals, can create ketosis, can create acidity, can cause us, it's just fasting can be like no exercise. When you have prolonged fasting, yes, you can turn on stem cells. Yes, in certain individuals, they'll be more likely to activate and do some healing. But in other individuals, you can get atrophy. So what does that mean? Well, if you don't exercise, your muscles, they break down and you get flabby muscles. If you don't exercise and eat through your, and utilize your gut and put food in it, not all day long, but certainly within an, you know, for an 8 or 12 hour window, not through the entire 12 hour window, but during the day, you will get atrophy of the cells of the GI tract. So in order to nourish and to keep those cells strong and healthy, like our muscle cells, we need to exercise them. We need to have them working appropriately. We need to give them the nutrients that they need and the food that they need in order for them to function effectively, to heal those 36 holes or those 2 holes or 3 holes or that permeable membrane within the GI tract, and to keep out the endotoxins and the LPS and the bugs and those things. We need to keep those things out of the body, and that requires utilizing the GI tract. Not overusing it and giving it lots of things to break down, but using it appropriately with things that are readily broken down, foods that are readily broken down, and foods that are more complex that break down over time. So I think that fasting can have its benefits, but it's not necessarily good for every body. Again, with fasting, you can produce a little bit, if you break down the tissue, you produce more acidity, and that acidity can affect the brain. It can affect nausea, it can affect the gut, it can affect vomiting. There are many, many ways that it could have adverse effects. So I think that understanding whether you're the person who would benefit from fasting, that would require a visit with a clinician. What does your nutrient profile look like? Do you have imbalances or deficiencies that need to be replenished, that indicate that the gut's not working well? And what do we need to do to heal that gut? If you have insulin problems, blood sugar problems, and you have diabetes, the childhood form of diabetes, and you are fasting, you will end up with a ketosis. And with a ketosis from fasting, with low carbohydrates, you will end up with nausea, vomiting, severe abdominal pain that necessitates a visit to the hospital, not just the emergency room, but the ICU, and you will end up needing to go on IVs, replace your minerals and your nutrients like your potassium to restore balance in that sugar. I think it's really, really tricky business. I'm not opposed to fasting, but I'm opposed to using fasting as a population-based approach to healing the gut or any other problem.
I think fasting is part of the pendulum. Because what happened, pardon?
Well said.
Because, yes, I think it's a piece, it's the other side of the pendulum. And what has happened is that with all the advertisements and the snack foods and the this and the that, I mean, I know my child goes to a game, he eats something, they expect, they give the kids snacks before the game, they give the kids snacks in the middle of the game, they give the kid, like, these are deprived children without enough calories, and they're constantly feeding them. And what we're seeing, you and I and Carol, what we're seeing is the illness of excess and of excess food, excess eating, and fasting is the other side of the pendulum. But I think there's somewhere in the middle, and Carol and I talk about this regularly, and they call it intermittent fasting.
Brilliant.
But what it really is exactly the way Europeans eat. They don't snack. They don't snack. And when dinner is over, they stop eating. No more. That's it. They're not going to and from the refrigerator 100 times before they go to bed. It's over. Ended. And
yes.
And yes. So you're getting the best of both. And you're getting the best of both. You have a window of eating. You eat a light something for breakfast. And you drink a warm beverage, you eat a adequate and generally healthy lunch, and then you eat a light something at dinner time, but it's very light. And then that's it. No more. All gone. And then if people come visit you, or if you, you know, you on Sunday, you eat a dessert that's homemade, and it's made of eggs, and made of a real, it's real food. It's not just chemicals put together for flavoring. So I think fasting is the response to excess. And I think where we really need to go is right there in the middle. I think a lot of what we're seeing is this excessive, uncontrolled snacking that keeps our insulin up and keeps us food craving continuously and always ready to digest. And I think that that's an important way. It's an intermittent fast to heal our guts also.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. I think that that's absolutely right. It's really the reality of the way we used to eat and should continue to eat, and the Europeans eat. I totally agree with you. And intermittent fasting, which is in, you know, it can be anywhere from 12 to 16 hours of not eating during a day, a 24-hour window, where the food not, you know, continuously between the 8 or 12 hours is eaten, but, you know, is eaten in separated by time. I think that that is the most reasonable way to eat in moderation, and as opposed to just consuming nonstop.
And what happened?
I wanted to bring up something where not touched on it, but just today I went to a Korean mega supermarket. And what really struck me was the variety and the unusual tuber kind of things that they offered, bins and bins of these starchy things that I can't begin to think about how to cook it because I just don't know. I have no experience. But the offerings were major, and people were buying these things. And resistant starches in your diet, and many people of different cultures have different kinds of these starchy materials in their diet, and these end up being extremely good for your microbiome. They're the things that healthy bacteria want to be fed, plantain, or a sweet potato might be something I'm more familiar with. I'm thinking that culturally we've backed up and gone into so many junk foods and things you don't spend any time preparing. It was amazing to me to see the variety of things and offered in this grocery store.
They're very high in fiber. And they're even lower in starch. They're lower in starch and higher in fiber. I remember Dr. Ali used to say, large bowel, small hospital, small bowel, large hospitals.
That's brilliant. That is fabulous.
I pick up quotes like that. Things like that never leave my memory.
But that is wonderful.
To the audience, you know, you might have, I know you have been listening and learning and enjoying, but I've got a little confession to make. Dr. Kathleen and Carol and I got together for a whole weekend of this at the beginning of the summer, and anybody coming to join the group couldn't get in a word edgewise. We were just sharing and learning and experiencing, and it was so much fun. I just really enjoyed it. So on the air, I wanted to thank Dr. Kathleen for being here with us. It's unfortunate our hour is ending. And thank Carol. Carol, I always learn. I always love when we're together. But when the three of us are together, hold on to your hats.
It's true. It's always so wonderful.
Uh-huh. So, Dr. Kathleen, could you give us your website? Oh, there's something that I'm going to repeat of you. There are two things that you say. One is treat wellness, and that a true doctor treats wellness and doesn't wait until you become ill. But go on, your website, please.
Right. My website has been taken down.
Oops.
By some major hacker.
Yeah.
We treat wellness, and it has been for 12 years, but more recently I posted some videos on wellness, and it was taken down. So I will get, in our next meeting here, I'd love to be invited back. Hope that can happen, not only to the radio show, but also to be with you too, because it's fantastically fun. But I will get that to you on the next show. I've been working assertively on this, and it's literally been dismantled.
Wow. Amazing.
Okay. We can actually post it on our Facebook when you're ready.
Wonderful.
We have Take Charge of Your Health at WBAI Facebook page, and when you're ready, just let us know. We'll post it there.
Thank you. I'm going to get on this. I'm on this week. It's been really distressing, but it will be back. We'll be back.
Good. We look forward to it. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us. Thank you, Carol. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you both.
Bye.
Bye-bye. In conclusion, I'd like to say, remember, this information is not an attempt to diagnose or a substitute for treatment. As always, we urge you to take this and all other information we share with you up with your healthcare practitioner. Clearly, this comes under the category of taking charge of your health. You can hear this program in its entirety on my Facebook, Corinne Fornari, RPA CCN, or on Take Charge of Your Health Facebook page, Take Charge of Your Health. My website is fornarihealth.com, and my office number is 212-219-0700. That's 212-219-0700. And I know many of you noticed that beautiful music, a big change. My brother's group wrote it for me. Left Hook from Redding, California. Their website is Redding Left Hook. Really special. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.